Welcome to the Poisoner's Cabinet. I'm Sinead.
And I'm Nick.
And this is your weekly podcast exploring the lives of the great poisoners and poisoning cases from across the centuries and creating curious cocktails inspired by the tales that we tell. And it's episode 38.
Woo!
Woo!
Woo! Woo! On the eve of lockdown.
On the eve of lockdown is when we recorded this. It comes out in the midst of lockdown.
That's true. That wasn't quite as dramatic as I thought it was going to be.
To anyone who is in lockdown and this is their only salvation, this podcast, this is it. This is what's going to get you through.
Sure, absolutely. This is often the case.
Oh, yeah. Don't you even look out the window, guys. It's an apocalypse out there. This podcast is the only thing that you
terrifying
need.
Terrifying place.
How are you, Nick?
I'm all right.
You're all right.
It's all right. Yeah, UK is going into lockdown stage two. So that'll be interesting. So this is the last podcast we will be doing in person.
No.
The rest of them will be via Zoom.
Ah, we've done it before.
We've done it before.
We'll do it again.
Yes, indeed.
We don't have to see each other's horrible faces.
Thank God for that.
Oh, God, it's just every
it is a blessing,
week is
really.
An ordeal.
It's a blessing.
I'll miss you. but you've been away this weekend. You managed to get away.
I managed
bastard.
To get away a few days arranged before the lockdown was announced, so fantastically well timed. Yes, a little staycation. A little oldie cottage with a big fire and gallons of wine.
Nice.
And it was very pleasant.
Oh, everyone has been away. And I was sensible. I was like, no, I won't book anywhere to go. It's irresponsible. And there's a couple of people I follow on Instagram and who are travel writers. And one of them went away to Greece for work. And it's just like, I'm just going to stay in Greece for lockdown. Just staying in Athens in a beautiful villa. And I'm like...
Yeah, I didn't quite go that far. I went to a cottage on the main road.
But you recreated the Greek myths when you were there.
So, not quite that exciting. But it was nice to escape for a bit.
Yeah, well, any poisonings on your journeys?
I mean, my liver is...
Oh, is it just gone?
It's just gone.
And you did have company when you were away.
I did have company, yes. I went with a friend. I went with our expert witness, Miss Rowena Bond.
Yay!
So, she's a good friend of mine. So, and Miss Sinead.
That's nice. I wasn't invited.
You weren't invited, no.
No, I had other things to do with my other friends.
Yes, you did.
Mr. Jack and Mr. Daniels. you know what we should do while we're on this outpouring of love and strangeness?
You're an outpouring of love.
You're an outpouring of strangeness.
Rage and hatred.
Well, in that vein, perhaps we should thank our Patreon subscribers.
In the vein of rage and hatred.
Yes.
Thank you.
We love them because they're very
they
sexy.
They are marvellous indeed. Thank
and they're
you
wonderful.
Very much. I'm somewhat amazed that we're approaching 100 people who actually voluntarily give up their hard-earned cash to listen to us witter on. Thank you so much to everyone out there who does listen to us on Patreon. And if you don't, where are you?
Genuinely, we really, from the bottom of our hearts, as much as we joke, we so appreciate all of our Patreon subscribers, all of our fans and all of our listeners. It means so much to us. It really makes a difference. Obviously, we're about to go into lockdown. There's a lot of artists and a lot of people out there struggling. So every little helps. We so appreciate your support. We love you. Thank you. But especially this week, we love...
Indeed, we do. Indeed, we do. We do. We do. Thank you so much to M. Wag.
To Corrine Todd.
And to Helen Hodge.
Thank you,
darling people.
Well, Nick.
Yes.
Are you ready to drink cocktails and talk about poison?
Oh.
It was a simple question, Nick.
There we go. There it is.
There it is. We could drink poison and talk about cocktails.
You sound so excited by that prospect.
I'm just getting ready for lockdown.
I'm going to go with a potentially of a cocktail. I have an interesting one.
Okay, so we'll go with the first one.
We're going to go with the first one.
Go with the first one. Go with the first one. Yay. Well, if we're going to talk about poison, we can't possibly do that without a cocktail in hand.
Such a thing would be madness.
And every week, we create a cocktail that is inspired by the tale that we tell, and it features a secret ingredient that will flavour our beverage of the week. And so, Nick...
Yes.
It's your story.
It is.
And the secret ingredient is...
Is wine.
Wine?
Is red wine.
Red wine. Okay. So I'm excited for this.
I'm intrigued by this.
I like a red wine.
Yeah, well, indeed. I have a glass of the red wine on the go at the moment. So, yeah, it's going to be an interesting one. It comes to me on recommendation, and I just hope I can do it justice.
Red wine, the only red wine cocktails I know, the only ones that are coming to my head, and I know loads of our listeners have jumped in with, hey, there's this red wine cocktail, really great suggestions. All I can think of is in Spain, they drink red wine and Diet Coke. Or Coke.
Yeah, they're also doing that in China as well.
Yeah. What is up with that? I mean, I've never tried it.
I don't know why it is. It seems a dreadful, dreadful thing to do.
A terrible thing to do to a fine wine. Indeed. Or a Diet Coke.
Well, yes, exactly. Both those perfectly lovely beverages on their own. I would never think to mix them, I must admit.
Blasphemy.
So no, I haven't made that one.
Oh, so with red wine then, yes. What have you come up with?
Well, we have got, I have no idea why it's called this. The cocktail is called the JFK Harris. No okay. idea why it's called the JFK Harris.
JFK Harris.
In the book I've got, it doesn't offer an explanation as to why it is called that. Yep, I don't know. But it's, I know I bang on about the Diffords book an awful lot.
Yes.
But if you're into cocktails, there's another book called Regarding Cocktails. By a chap called Sasha Petrasky, and I probably pronounced that horribly wrong. Unfortunately, now passed away. But one of the main people behind the resurgence of cocktails.
Wow.
He opened up Milk and Honey in New York. And so he was one of the first people behind this sort of recent resurgence in cocktails and making exquisite drinks. And this is a book with a lot of his recipes in and a lot of anecdotes about his life and reminiscences of people. And it is a stunning book just to sit and read. And this is one of the cocktails from there. So I'd very much recommend the book.
We'll share a picture of the book maybe when we do the cocktail. Yeah, sure. Guys, buy it. Because obviously you know about Diffords, but yeah, let's buy the book. Okay. So JFK Harris. Now I'm just thinking about what the hell the Harris was the connection to. I could look it up, but maybe you listeners can tell me. It wasn't the car. I'm just immediately going to his assassination. I mean, he had many, many years before he was killed that we could talk about. All right, I'm going to move on from the JFK conspiracies and go into the poisonous cabinet kitchen and shake up a storm. So see you in a minute.
See you in a bit.
And we're back.
Hello.
Woo! A JFK Harris.
JFK Harris, indeed.
And now you've since discovered what the JFK...
I did investigate, and I found out what the JFK Harris stands for. Nothing to do with JFK. Hmm. Actually, the initials of a dear friend of the person who concocted this cocktail. That is where the name comes from.
That's lovely. And when you say investigate, do you mean you just read further down the
page? I read further down the page and the little notes at the bottom. No, I got more books out. I googled things. I phoned up the author.
Who's dead.
And found out this endearing story. Or I read further.
But a JFK Harris. So this one looks damn pretty.
It looks amazing.
It really does. This is one of the best looking drinks I've ever seen.
It does look stunning. So I'm hoping it's going to taste. I mean, it's a very strange combination of ingredients. It's certainly not nothing that I would ordinarily put together.
Okay, talk us through it.
So it's a rum-based drink. So it's a variation of a mojito, basically. So you've got rum.
Oh, okay.
You have got a bit of mint.
Nice.
You have got lemon.
Nice.
And sugar. So it's those all mixed together.
Yeah.
And then with a layer of, I mean, it's a fraction. It's like a quarter of an ounce of red wine floated on top.
Yes. Oh, because it is probably floated. It looks almost Halloween-y. So where was this in Spooky Week?
Indeed. So if you look at the pictures that I'll be out later this evening, you'll see the very definite layering of those two things, which I did not think it was going to work as well as it has.
Oh, my God.
So I'm just intrigued to...
I'm so excited.
To try it.
Okay, so should we dive in and try it?
Let's give it a go.
I can't wait a moment longer. Right, indeed. So JFK Harris, cheers.
Mm, cheers.
Mmm.
I think that's really nice.
It's really nice.
That red wine works actually surprisingly well.
Can I taste the red wine?
Well, I can.
Nick, can I taste it?
Well, I can.
Let me just try it again. Hang on.
You do get a hint of it, because it stays on top, so you get a mouthful of it.
No, it's delicious,
but
though.
I'm delighted about how lovely that
that's
is.
That's really nice. I mean, it's better than a mojito, in my opinion.
I really like that.
I'm
really surprised.
It's a really nice mixture of flavours. The nice red wine is. On top adds... Yeah, I don't know what it is. Well, that must be the little bit of umami, isn't it? Yeah, it must be the little extra thing that I'm going, I don't know what it is. It's a bit of wan.
It's wan.
Yes. Now, do you want to talk us through what happened with this drink accidentally?
Okay. Full confession, I forgot to buy fresh mint on my way home this evening. So I was like racking my brains of what have I got in the house. I thought, well, I've got creme de menthe. That can be about overpowering. Oh, I've got some mint tea bags.
Which are made from fresh mint.
Which are made from mint. Okay, well, I'll put a tea bag into the shaker and see how it goes. It did not. The tea bag unsurprisingly split. So it is a rather textured... I'm going to go textured cocktail.
Full disclosure as well, while I'm laughing at this, I'm laughing at it hearing it back of how ridiculous an idea it was.
She was all behind me
on this. I was here, Nick's housemate, we were all, like, totally, mate, oh yeah, you know what you want to do? You want to get a tea bag in there. Now I hear it. And I'm like, oh my God, why did you do that?
It's foolproof. so I did that with the tea bag, and I tried it, and I wasn't getting any of the mint at all. So I did add drop of Creme de Menthe, which has, I thought it was going to be overpowering, but it was the tiniest of drops.
Yeah,
and I make
these
cocktails in quantities of two for enough for both of us, probably an eighth of an ounce for two cocktails sort of thing. So the tiniest of amounts.
And it works.
And I think it's worked because there is a slight hint, ever so slightly in the background, but it's not overpowering at all. Of course, fresh mint would have been so much better, but I'm desperately disorganised and
I like it. And again, I've gone a bit weird on fresh mint in cocktails. I grow it at home. I decided this summer I shall grow lots of mint and use it in cocktails, and then I put them in cocktails and go, I don't like it.
So,
I have it in mint tea. I make my own mint tea. But I think it can be overpowering in cocktails because once you get it, it is even the smallest amount of mint leaves. It's like spearmint. It's like toothpaste and it overpowers the drink. So this, whatever you've done,
it works.
With a little hint of the creme de menthe and the tea baggy goodness,
I think the tea baggy goodness has added nothing to it at all.
It's made it look herby.
It's made it look herby indeed. So I'm intrigued to try it actually with some fresh mint to see what difference that makes. But either way, I think it is a damn good cocktail.
That is a really nice cocktail and it is a stunner as well. That's a good, again, another good party piece. Much better than the brandy cruster, which is a great talking point, does not look sexy.
No.
Whereas this looks sexy.
And also this one is going to be made out of stuff you have at home. It requires nothing fancy.
Yeah.
It is Bacardi rum, white rum, lemon juice, sugar, some mint, and a bottle of red wine. As stuff that everyone has at home. And you can make this and it looks stunning and it is a classy cocktail.
Yeah. And if you don't have fresh mint, as we've proven, just fucking improvise. just improvise.
Just chuck a teabag in there.
Hey. Yeah. Well, we have our JFK Harris's, and I'm disappointed it's not about JFK. Because
about
really with the float on top, it could be to do with this assassination.
Yes, I know. I thought you were gonna go that way, but it's really not.
Well, with our JFK Harris's firmly in hand.
Yes.
Delicious. Is it time for a story, Nick?
It is time for a story.
Hooray!
It is time for a story. In this week, we are returning to France.
France!
To the land of the Marquise de Brinvilliers, to Marie Lafarge, to the Marquis de Sade, and the notorious affair of the poisons.
Indeed.
A land where poisoners roam the streets and plan despicable crimes.
Okay.
They do. That's what France is all about.
That's what France is all about. And France is a lovely place, all of our French
well, it
listeners.
Was back then.
Well, now you can't fucking go out.
So we start our tale in 1774.
Nice.
Where we will meet Monsieur Étienne Saint-Faux de Lamotte.
It's a big name.
It's a big name. He's a fancy man. Provincial noble from a really ancient and well-respected noble family. He's up there. He's got a big house. People like him.
Up there?
Up what? There in the society of...
Oh, right. I was like, society. Is this house on a hill? I'm sorry. That's what I pictured. He was like lording it over everyone below him. I'm sorry.
No, he's just a very fancy man.
Okay.
So Étienne Saint-Faux had been equerry to the King of France. So in charge of the King of France's horses. But when he married, he moved his family to his country estate, Boussonceif, which was just on the outskirts of Paris. He went so he could bring up his family, sort of in peace and quiet, away from the hustle and bustle and intrigue and stabbings of court life and general poisonings, as we have discovered. With the So off they go to their country estate. And they live there happily for many years. But as their son grows older, de Lamotte becomes anxious to leave the country and return to Paris, to return to court, where he hopes to obtain a position for his son. So in May 1775, Monsieur de Lamotte gives power of attorney to his wife so that she can go into Paris and negotiate the sale of their country estate. They're going to buy some beautiful house in the centre of Paris, no doubt, move to where it's all happening.
And she can get past the roaming poisoners on the street.
Well, she's probably got like a footman or something who's poking them away with a stick.
Okay,
so she's fine. I mean, obviously, this shows great faith in his wife.
Damn straight.
You go and do it. So the negotiation and the finding the buyer is given down to her, but the sort of the formal side is placed in the hands of a lawyer, a chap called Monsieur Joly.
Oh, how nice. Mr. Happy.
Mr. Happy. Mr. Happy is...
Ah, Monsieur Joly. Yeah, it was ironic that he was such a dour, sad, depressed man. drowned his cat.
So he is in charge of the legal side of the sale. Now, they are very fortunate that Monsieur Joly has actually the perfect client in mind for the sale of the house, a Monsieur Derues de Cyrano de Berry, Lord of Candeville, Hershey's, and many, many other fancy places.
Right, okay.
He is in the market for a new country estate.
So Cyrano de Bergerac is also in charge of some chocolate.
De Cyrano de Berry.
De Berry.
De Berry.
Oh, so he's in charge of the
Lord
berries.
Of Canterville and her shiz.
Shiz.
So throughout this episode, you will be regaled with my excellent French pronunciation.
I'm French it up, Nick. So French it up.
It's going to be. He is in the market for a new country retreat, somewhere to settle and start his own life with his new family. So they think, perfect. Obviously, a lordly, noble chap.
He has many names.
He has many titles. He is desperately impressed. No one's ever heard of him before.
No.
But he's got all these names and titles, so he's bound to be fancy.
Okay.
And he ticks all the boxes for the de la Mottes. I mean, they're not going to sell the family home to any old commoner. None of that. It needs to be put into good hands.
Yes.
Someone who's going to look after it and continue the reputation that it has. So there's quite a stringent, almost interviewing process that Madame de la Motte goes through to vet potential buyers. And they settle on Monsieur Deroux. He's known as such a pleasing and accommodating gentleman. He was said to have been very delicate to all appearances, strangely pale, slight, fragile in build, with his beardless chin and feminine cast of features. There was something cat-like in the soft, insinuating smile of his seemingly most amiable, candid and pious of men. He sounds a delight.
He sounds a delight, yes. Part of me is like, is he a woman in disguise?
Well, you say this.
Oh, good God. What? Have I just ruined the story? You have
ruined
then?
The story. Not quite. No. But we will.
So he's a weird, paley kind of ghostly figure.
And if you see pictures of him, there are sort of sketches and stuff of him. And he is a very slight, slender chap. But he has this reputation and he comes across as the most charming of gentlemen. So very pleasant.
Kind of a Quentin Crisp sort of character.
Potentially so, yes indeed. I mean, say it is a pleasure to do business with Monsieur Deroux. He is always cheerful, optimistic. After one or two interviews, are delighted to have found this bar, and they wholeheartedly go, yes, absolutely. Now, Monsieur Deroux and his wife visit. Boussoncef is the name of the estate. They visit several times during this whole process, and they are themselves enchanted by what they see. It's a big estate, lots of land. They have vineyards. They produce a wine that is not exported, but sent all over the country and is well regarded.
Wine?
A lovely, lovely wine.
Red wine!
They produce a lovely wine that is well sought after and very well regarded.
Delicious. Is it Blue Nun?
It is not Blue Nun, no.
But it is piss, then, isn't it?
By the end of December 1775, the sale is finalised. Everything is in order. Monsieur Deroux agrees to pay 130,000 livres, which in today's money is about £1.6 million.
Bargain, mate.
I don't know what that is in dollars. Probably about
$2
million.
$2 million. Let's just say that.
So a considerable sum. And the payments are to be made in instalments. The first of 12,000 livres is to be paid on the actual signing of the contracts. But in the meantime, as an act of good faith, Monsieur Deroux gives Madame de la Motte like a promissory note for 4,200 livres, which is due to be paid on the 1st of April.
Right.
So almost like a cheque to say, on the 1st of April, I agree, I will pay you this sum of money. And it's a legal document sort of thing.
Okay, fine.
Like a forward dated cheque.
But he's doing an early payment.
Exactly, before that, as a good faith sort of thing, he's doing that now.
He
says
promises,
he promises
here's a bit of
to
paper.
Do this now. Look,
that's as good as
exactly,
money.
On the bit of paper, this is what I'm going to, is what I will give you on the 1st of April. Now we're going to turn our attention to Monsieur Deroux himself.
Okay.
We need to have a chat about him, I feel.
Shall we?
I mean, no one's ever heard of him. Before this,
which is surprising with the name, the length.
Well,
that he
exactly.
Has.
I mean, he has just appeared on the Paris scene one day.
Is he a ghost?
Then? He's not a ghost. He's actually a very real person. But you say he's appeared, and he's appeared to be a very respectable gentleman on the lookout for this grand estate to settle his family and make his name. But it turns out that Monsieur Deroux de Solano de Belli, Lord of Canterville, Hersheys, etc., is not quite who he claims to be.
Surely not.
Unsurprisingly, not quite who he claims to be.
He's not the Lord, is he only the Viscount?
He is a mere Duke.
That's higher than a Lord, yes. Nick.
But no, he's none of them.
He's not none of that. Jesus Christ. Not even a captain.
Not even a captain. He's nothing. I mean, so not only does he not have a drop of aristocratic blood anywhere near him, he is as far from rich as you could possibly get.
Oh, no.
He is a grocer.
Yes.
He is a greengrocer, penniless, crippled with debt, but with big dreams.
Wow.
But he's ambitious. He's ambitious.
I'm going to quit this vegetable stall.
Exactly.
Don't worry, darling, I have a plan.
He has a plan. Oh my God, he has plans.
Bloody hell. He's invented the longest name in the world.
Yep, absolutely.
He could have just stopped at the first bit.
Well, not as fancy. So
suspicious. Suspicious.
No one so far is suspicious.
Well, yes. I mean, if he's been to visit all of them, he's been done to all visit, of this, and they've been absolutely taken in by it, so he's charming, clearly.
Oh, he's desperately charming. Desperately charming. So, right. I mean, Anton François Duroux was his name. He was born in Chartres in 1744. His father is a corn merchant. His mother is a housewife. But both his parents die when he's very young, 3 years old. And he is sent to live with relatives. So in my early description of him, he's described as having very delicate features, very feminine in appearance.
Yes.
In one of the reports of his life, it is actually claimed that for quite some time after his birth, he was actually assumed to be female. He was assumed to be a girl.
Okay.
And it was not until he was 12 years old that an operation determined that he was actually male.
Okay, I have questions.
So there was obviously some sort of intersex at birth. They were not able to differentiate between him being male or female. So he was assumed to be female. And it was only until much later, say he was 12 years old, when they actually did an operation to determine that he was actually
biologically
male. And it is a real thing. It does happen. It's incredibly rare. But it is possible. It's completely indeterminate. We cannot tell if he's a boy or a girl at this time, when he's born. And probably, incredibly weird for... I mean, a child of relatively humble background. So he's not going to have, fancy court doctors and stuff like that. Yeah. It's going to be your local crazy midwife.
Well, is this a crazy midwife who didn't know what a penis looked like?
You would have thought if they still had to wait till he was 12, that someone would have noticed.
Unless it was the same crazy midwife.
Obviously, they're not going to be particularly experienced with these such rarities. So he's probably something quite the talking point, or something that was recorded and remarked upon.
Not awful to have that, but to grow up in that environment when no one understands
what's going on. But at the age of 12, he is determined he was female, but obviously he has these very feminine attributes about him. So apart from all that, he goes to live with his relatives, and he is apprenticed to a grocer to make a career for himself.
He made a lot of money as a grocer,
and he does do incredibly well. And in 1770, he's actually able to set up his own business in Paris. So he's in his early 20s. He's been so successful that he's now got his own store, but he has always believed that he is destined for better things. This is not where his life is meant to be, as being a grocer. No matter how good he is at it, there is something better out there. In 1772, he marries and causes quite a stir amongst his friends and acquaintances by claiming that his new wife is actually of noble birth and an heiress. Now, the first statement is entirely bollocks. There is nothing noble about her whatsoever.
She a great big slut.
She's not a great big slut, no. But her name is Marie-Louise Nicolet. She is the daughter of an artillery officer, which is no bad thing, but not aristocratic. But what he does, he removes the S from the end of her name, which Duroux is also careful to erase on the marriage contract, and he is able to connect his wife with the noble house of Nicolai. One of the most distinguished and great of French noble houses.
Yes.
So just by smudging out that S, his wife in name has turned into someone quite important. Mm. There's a bit more truth in the statement that Madame Duroux is an heiress. She is. A distant relative of her mother has become heir to the Marquis d'Esprez, distantly related. Now, the Marquis is known as a rude, solitary, brutal man, devoted to sport. He lives alone in his castle of Canderville, which is where Duroux has stolen the title from. But he is hated by his neighbours. He's just a thoroughly despised man.
He's a bit like Roy Keane.
And one day he is found laying dead in his bedroom.
Oh, good God.
Shot in the chest.
Wow.
The window open. The assassin has escaped.
Of course. Of course, that's what happens, yes.
And I mean, this mystery, this murder is actually never solved. No one...
So hated, shot in so his own hated. Bed, and someone fled.
So his estate was divided amongst three cousins, whom the mother of Madame Duroux is one of.
Right.
Now, Duru is convinced that this inheritance that his mother-in-law is in line for is going to be the solution to all his problems. So my mother-in-law is going to inherit a third of the Marquis estate, and my life is sorted.
This is what we've had before with people going, oh, there's going to be an inheritance, and no one reads the fine print. They just go, oh, an inheritance is coming. I will give up my job. I'm going to buy this armoire. I'm going to buy all this art, and the inheritance is fourpence.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's not just going for the armoire. He's going for the whole fucking estate filled with armoires.
He's just turning up the thing going, I have 9 armoires. I need somewhere to put them. I hope you have an armoires room.
So, I mean, he is convinced that this is his way out of the life of a lowly grocer. But 5 years pass. The inheritance and the estate is still going through all the courts. People are challenging it in this limbo status, and no money has been paid out whatsoever. And if Duru is to receive any of this money, which in itself is probably very unlikely after 5 years of court fees and lawyers and all that sort of stuff, probably a pittance left out of it, not going to be sufficient to cover his own debts, let alone buying a fancy house somewhere in the country. So his financial situation is relatively critical, and he is obviously certainly not content with the money of a modest income he gets as a grocer. So in a somewhat foolhardy attempt to increase his fortunes, he becomes a moneylender.
Okay.
But not just any moneylender, but a moneylender to sort of somewhat spendthrift and embarrassed nobles.
Oh, that's clever.
Well, okay. Clever in theory. So, I mean, he is delighted to receive sort of dukes and marquises and all these sorts of aristocrats to his home who come looking for a bailout.
But they're not going to pay him back, are they? They're not going to give a shit.
This is a problem that he encounters. So he himself borrows money at a relatively low interest rate, and then he then lends that money to these fancy noble people at a higher rate of interest, thinking, well, I'm going to make my money back, and then I can
to
pay off.
To these rich people who need to borrow
to
money.
These really desperately fancy rich people. Who aren't that rich because they need to borrow money from me.
Never a lender nor a borrower be.
So, yeah, I mean, but this sort of smiling grocer, he receives people in his flowered dressing gown. Quite a flamboyant sort of chap.
He's definitely Quentin Crisp. He's Quentin Crisp.
He wears it, and he's pictured actually with this strange sort of bonnet thing going on.
Great.
He's always ready to oblige a request from someone fancy, ingratiate himself with another noble house sort of thing.
Is this what he thinks that fancy people want when it comes to the house? So he's going, I better dress up. And so he's put on a giant flowery dressing gown and a lady's bonnet. And the dukes are probably coming in and going, great, I can borrow from him because he's fucking crazy.
He's fucking insane. Absolutely. This aristocratic moneylending proves hopeless, as we've said. It plunges him deeper and deeper into disaster. The noblemen either forget to pay. They can't be bothered with some little
flowery bonnety man.
Or they die, and it discovers that they are entirely penniless.
Yeah.
And their much more substantial debts get paid off first. And him who's lent them a few hundred quid, or the equivalent of, is probably right at the bottom of the pile of people to get paid back. And he never receives a penny of this money.
This was not a good plan.
And he is driven to ordering goods from his grocery store on credit from his suppliers and selling them at a lower price just so he can get the cash flow going.
Oh, God.
So he's making a loss, but he needs the money. So that's fending off some more creditors for just a little bit longer.
It's not a happy place.
It's not good. I mean, people are starting to tire of the sort of his claims. This inheritance is going to come through at any moment. Next week, I'm going to be as rich as anything. I will pay you back in full with interest. Not a problem. Now, he said that a few too many times.
Yeah.
Really? Not entirely sure. It's bollocks. So Paris is getting a bit too hot. It's getting there's a few too many people wanting a piece of him. If only he could find a nice, quiet country retreat where he might recuperate, enjoy perhaps a bit of the lifestyle of a country gentleman.
Just get a cottage. Just get a cottage. Just do what you did. Get a cottage with a nice fire and some bottles of wine and just go and recoup there. You don't need a fucking palace.
Well, he does, because then you can make your own wine.
Oh, God. So, oh, yeah, he's onto a money spinner there. You know what? If I buy this estate, I'll make my own wine. I'm quids in. I'm putting money in my own pocket. Sorry, I don't want to pronounce him as sort of a Del Boy-esque character. Yeah, exactly. It's all right. Next year, millionaires. Bloody hell.
But, I mean, nothing is going to stop his ambition and his overwhelming desire to become a gentleman.
Not even failure, constantly. Absolutely not.
He's going to be something with a fancy title. He's convinced he is going to do it. At the beginning of 1775, he actually purchases a relatively modest country house near Rouen. And he promises to pay 9,000 livres for the property, but he can't afford it. And non-payment results in the complete annulment of this contract. And once again, his sort of credit status, as it were, is downgraded again. But still, he is undefeated. He is not deterred. He is going to go for it, having failed to pay 9,000 livres for this modest estate near Rouy. I mean, he has no hesitation in committing to pay 130,000 livres from the lordly estate of Boussoncef.
I mean, this is like gambling addiction, isn't
it? Oh, completely.
This is totally...
Absolutely.
The same foolhardy, I can do this, I will be able to raise the money, complete faith in the system, play the odds, my money's going to come in soon.
I mean, so great is his confidence and his pride. He practices his new signature and new titles.
He bloody better, it's huge.
So Anton Francois...
What's he practicing on, oak trees?
Antoine Francois de Serrano Duré de Belly Signor de Boussoncef.
How many durs did he put
in there? There's a lot of durs going on there.
No one had that sort of name.
Oh, exactly. I mean, the aristocracy will be laughing at that title. Because it is so... Because I'm like Duke of... I'm the Duke of Burgundy. So... Small, to the point. That's just what I need.
Pick a place, mate. Pick a place.
No, he's very carried away with his titles and his, yeah.
Can't wait to sign anything.
Absolutely.
Brings out the biggest quill you've ever seen from his bonnet.
I mean, as we know from earlier, the first payment is due at the beginning of April 1776 for the estate. But instead of making it, he can't make it. Derues actually goes down to Boussoncef with his daughter, his young daughter. And he stays there as a guest of the de la Motte for 6 months. He is able, with his charm and his good humour and general loveliness, he wins over everyone. And he stays as guests of the de la Motte for 6 months.
Okay, on one hand, maybe these people are so boring and he's so charming that he's delightful, and any time that their attention wanes for a second, he gets the daughter to dance or something. Quick, you're a grand old flag, you're a... Or this has been written over the time that he must have been so charming, he just won't fucking leave. He doesn't live there. He's just moved in with his child. And there's just a guy living in your house. And if someone won't leave and you're being polite, going, but yeah, I think the Duke won't leave.
I think you've got to think that this is not like houses that we have now. These are much bigger.
I completely understand that. Lived in France for a while, not at that time, obviously.
In 1775.
I went back in time, and that's what I chose to do with my life. Didn't save JFK, didn't do anything else. But yes, in those houses, of course, people would go and stay for a period of time. But that's still pushing it. When they know nothing about this guy. And you can only be charming for so long. Go and move into a wing.
But he's in there?
We don't know. Maybe they didn't know he was there. They were just rattling around for ages.
Exactly.
It's such a big place
that they haven't seen him for months, so they assumed he's gone. So.
He turns up every now and then just to get more sausages.
I mean, the village priest especially loves having him around. He loves the company of such a devout and pious visitor. So they have great chats, wandering through the countryside, debating theological matters and such like.
Lovely. I do kind of love this guy. I am fully here for the fact that he can win everyone over.
Oh, he completely
can. He's just
can.
Lying about God for ages, winging it.
Oh, completely. He entertains his friends by dressing up as a woman, by being a female impersonator, which is obviously he's got the characteristics for since birth.
I'm going to go back to Quentin Crisp, but that would be the one person that you would have no problem staying in a chateau going, you stay at mate, stay.
Yeah,
tale of stories
absolutely.
Every night. Let's have a drink.
Can you imagine he must have been such an entertaining and probably have all these anecdotes. They're probably complete bollocks, but he's able to come up with these stories
having said all of that, I kind of really want this guy to win now. He sounds like he's got balls, but he's entertained. I don't mind if you're pushy, as long as you're fucking entertaining about it. Oh, absolutely.
Exactly. As long as you're, yeah, you bring something to the party.
Cook up a storm as well. He's got many vegetables.
I mean, if the subject of the house purchase is ever brought up, he goes off on a rant about the delay and the chicanery of lawyers.
Bastards.
It was that alone that has postponed this inheritance. As soon as the lawyers are out of the way, the money will come through and he can pay straight away.
Yeah.
But it is all someone else's fault. But as time goes on, no payment is forthcoming and the Delamotte do begin to feel a little questioning about, okay, have we made the right choice? Is this really going to go anywhere? So Delamotte does depart in November. He leaves and returns to Paris. And Monsieur Delamotte decides to send his wife to Paris to make a few discreet inquiries about what is going on with this inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
And possibly try and put some pressure, help speed things along slightly. And on her trip, she takes their 14-year-old son. Now, when Monsieur Delamotte finds out about the impending visit of Madame Delamotte, he goes into a panic. If she is allowed to sort of wander freely throughout Paris talking to people, she is going to find out he is not who he is claiming to be, and the whole thing is going to fall apart. That is not going to do at all. If she is going to visit, then it's going to be as his guest in return for their hospitality. Oh. So he sends an invitation.
Yeah, she could probably find out a few things if she's staying at the house.
Maybe so, absolutely. Save a few pounds on the fancy hotels and what have you.
Yep.
So in December 16th, 1776, Madame Delamotte arrives in Paris and begins her stay at the Delamotte's house. Her son is actually placed in a private school in a neighbouring street. Now, to Delamotte, there is one sort of immediate problem that needs to be solved. How to keep Besson Cef without paying for it. Aww. He wants this estate. He cannot afford it. Fortunately, he does have a plan. He
really?
Has a plan ready to be put into action. He will make a payment to Madame Delamotte.
Okay.
She is then going to disappear, taking her son with her. Now, before becoming Madame Delamotte, she had been Monsieur Delamotte's mistress. And their child was actually born out of wedlock. So there is already this sort of...
Hint of scandal.
Impropriety. And that is only going to lend weight to the story that Monsieur Delamotte paid for the estate, gave all the money to Madame Delamotte, and she then ran off with a lover.
She vanished,
taking her son, vanished with a lover, never to be seen again. He will then produce the necessary documents proving that he has paid this money and Besson Cef will be his. Now, there is slight one complication in this plan. The plan does hinge around the disappearance, willingly or unwillingly, of Madame Delamotte and her son. They are required to be not seen ever again. Now, Madame Delamotte has settled...
throw an Indian throw over her.
Yes, and then she's vanished.
Can't even see her.
Can't see her. She's gone.
Yeah, it's like clutter.
Yeah,
she's gone.
Exactly. Madame Delamotte has settled down quite nicely, and she is quite comfortable with the hospitality of the Monsieur Madame Delamotte. And she has shown no sign of pressing for this money or making any inquiries. She has spent a month enjoying Paris, catching up with old friends, visiting museums and galleries, and having a generally jolly time. Paris is lovely, absolutely. Doing a sightseeing.
Christmas.
It was towards the end of January that her health and the health of her son begins to fail. Oh, there's the coughing and the spluttering and the stomach aches.
Oh, no.
Madame Delamotte is seized by sickness.
No.
And by the 30th of January, she is confined to her bed. Monsieur Delamotte continues to write to her husband that his wife is well, business is almost completed, it's all going well, she'll be back soon as anything. Nothing untoward is going on whatsoever.
If he writes that into the letter, then that's some sort of indication. Nothing untoward is going on whatsoever. Nailed it.
Nailed it. Perhaps that was a PS. I don't know.
PS scrubbed out many times. Love and kisses.
On the 31st of January, the servant at the house is told to go home. You are not needed for the day. Go and visit your mother or something. Just get out of the house.
Okay. Just get out of here.
His wife, Monsieur Drew's wife and children, are sent out of the house to run some errands. Uh-huh. Delamotte is alone with his ailing patient in the house. Later that evening, a friend comes to dine with the Delamotte, and the friend asks, can I see Madame Delamotte? I hear she's unwell. I'd like to give her my best wishes. Impossible. She is far too frail, but making a splendid recovery.
Oh, good.
She'll be
good,
better,
good.
Back on her feet any day now. Now, the young Delamotte, her son, also visits that evening, saying, can I see my mother? I know she's unwell. I'd like to give give him my best. And Daru actually takes him up to the room. But the light is so dim, all he can see is a figure lying in the bed, apparently asleep. He creeps out quietly, not wanting to disturb or wake his mother. The next day, Madame Daru is again sent out shopping. Go and buy yourself something fancy. Go and buy a frock. Once again, Daru is alone with his patient. But she is a patient no longer. She is a corpse.
No.
Now, this highly successful medicine has worked just as planned.
Oh, my goodness.
Later that day, Daru comes out of the house and summons some porters. And with their help, he loads a heavy trunk onto a carriage. A big leather travelling trunk onto a carriage. And is taken to a house a few streets away, where he has rented out the cellar to store some wine.
Of course. Put the wine in the cellar. I need a cellar. I hear you put wine in a cellar. This is a damn horrible... Just put it fucking put the
wine,
in there, right?
That's where the wine lives. This is where the wine is going to go.
It doesn't clink. It seems to be moaning somewhat. That's what wine does when wine it's maturing.
It does, absolutely. It's mature wine.
Right. Are you a connoisseur? You're just a porter. Bloody put it in there.
Exactly. I'm something fancy. I know what I'm talking about.
Do you know how many names I have?
Now, that evening, the young de la Motte again pays a visit and is told by a beaming Monsieur de Roux that his mother has made a full recovery.
Right.
She is right as rain, and she has left of her Versailles to go and find her son a position at court. And we'll go and see her in a day or two, he says. A few days after that, he hires some workmen to dig a hole in the cellar floor of the cellar he has rented, giving his reasons that there's no better way of keeping wine than burying it. Which we all know to be absolutely true.
No, a lot of people did.
Buried wine is better wine.
Buried wine is good wine. But the more buried the wine, the gooder it is.
Exactly. So when the hole is deep enough, he sends the workman on his way, going, I will bury the wine. I will do it in the special wine burying way. So I will deal with that myself.
I'm trained in this.
Daru is seen for a few days coming and going from the cellar, and then until finally he is actually observed quite happily carrying out this large leather trunk. La 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 la, off I go with my large leather trunk. After that, he is never seen on the street again. Wednesday, the February the 12th, and Monsieur Beaupère of Commercy arrives at Versailles with his nephew. Monsieur Beaupère is a very pale, slight, slightly feminine gentleman, who seems to be very jolly, in excellent spirits, in spite of the fact that his supposed nephew is desperately ill, looks very, very sick, very, very unwell. The innkeeper, though they're staying with, suggests that he should definitely call a doctor for his nephew, who does not appear well at all. But Monsieur Beaupère says that is quite unnecessary. I have no faith in doctors. His illness is due to venereal disorders.
Wow, that's so mean.
It is a
How old is the son?
Well, he says that he's claimed to be 14.
Oh, well,
So, I mean, it is a priest this boy needs, not a doctor.
Okay, I have issues with both of that. It's,
So, yeah,
venereal disease will help by praying, apparently.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the way to get through it all.
Well, yeah, and through the cause of it, too.
Yeah. Thursday and Friday, the boy's condition shows no improvement. Vomiting continues. He is writhing in agony. On Saturday, Monsieur Beaupère declares himself as delighted that the success of his medicine. He's going to be right as rain. That night he's dead.
Right.
He did not go as well.
Oh, dear.
The following day, Louis-Anton Beaupère, aged 22 and a half, on his gravestone, is buried at Versailles.
22 and a half?
That's what he's claimed to be on the
gravestone. Oh, my God. He was 14. But he's actually 14. Oh, my God.
And he is buried at Versailles. His deeply pious uncle leaves the priest with 6 livres to pay for prayers for his nephew's soul.
Well, that's good for him.
That evening, Monsieur Delu, back in Paris, back in his lovely home,
invites, down the Moulin Rouge.
Exactly. He invites all his friends for dinner to celebrate. He has reunited the young de la Motte with his mother in Versailles. They are now happily ever after. He has paid for the Besancon estate in full. The best joke of all, he says, is no sooner that they have settled the business than she has gone off with a former lover. She has run off, her and her son, run off with the money, run off with his lover, and would all probability never be heard of again. Monsieur Delu has in his possession a deed of sale that he has claimed has been signed by Madame de la Motte, and a document acknowledging the payment to her of 100,000 livres. So he has got all this in writing.
Clever boy.
At Besancon, Monsieur de la Motte is waiting for news from his wife. On Saturday 17th, the day after the return of Derues from Versailles, he hears from Madame Derues that his wife has left Paris and gone with his son to Versailles. A second letter tells him that they have completed the sale. It's all gone through fantastically. All is well. I'm sure you're here any day now.
Lovely.
Days pass, nothing.
No.
Nothing is heard from Madame de la Motte. On the 28th of February, Derues, accompanied by the parish priest, he actually arrives to Besançon. And initially, Monsieur de la Motte is delighted to see the man. Perhaps he'll get some news of his wife, but he's bitterly disappointed when Derues can only tell him that what he's already been told, that his wife has sold their estate and fucked off.
It's all falling into place.
It's all well. Monsieur de la Motte is not convinced, though, by this. I mean, how all of a sudden has Derues found 100,000 livres out of nowhere, where he had pennies before? Where has all this money come from? And Derues says he's borrowed it from a friend. It's a very generous friend.
Yeah, suddenly,
to give £1.6 million.
Do you not have friends like that?
Unfortunately,
if you
not.
Ever needed £1.6 million, I would probably find someone to get that.
That's very kind. But and there is no use talking about it. That the place is now his. He owns it. He's got signed documents. So you have no right to be here anymore. Get out of my house.
Ooh, the bitchy side of him's
coming
out.
The bitchy side is starting to come out, absolutely. Of course, he's desperately sorry that his wife has gone off and left him without a penny. But it's really not my problem. I mean, I've already sold 40 casks of last year's vintage. So would you mind sending them off as well? That'd be great. If you could do that for me, that'd be great. I mean, de la Motte is furious. He is absolutely livid at the arrogance of this little upstart. He tells Derues that this story is a pack of lies, utter nonsense. He is still master at Besançon, and not a bottle of wine will leave it without his say-so. I know something has happened to my wife and child. I'm coming to Paris myself, and if it is as I fear, you shall answer for it with your head.
Yes.
So he's on the
good for him.
Absolutely.
Good for him, because he trusted his wife and he gave his wife, yeah, it's like, you go and do the business
now,
but I have faith in you.
I have faith in you.
She wouldn't run off on him and I believe him.
No, yeah. Indeed. I mean, Derues is worried. I mean, de la Motte, he is still a powerful, influential noble. He has got friends in Paris. He has got friends at court. The grocer will be no match for him. I mean, lawsuits are expensive. The results are uncertain.
And it's all going to come tumbling down.
And it's all going to come out in the... Yeah, absolutely. Under interrogation, this is all going to come out. But what is he going to do? And he asks his friends, what is he going to do? I don't know how much he divulges to his friends about his plans. What is he going to do? And the general opinion is that, well, fresh news of Madame de la Motte, her reappearance, would probably settle things entirely. If she was to make an appearance, if she was to write a letter, then any question of her disappearance or anything untoward would be settled because she has made contact. She's
Fair
not
enough.
Disappeared. Now, Monsieur Derues ponders this and goes, well, I've made her disappear. I can make her reappear. Absolutely.
Because he is a magician.
Because he is a magician. On the evening of 7th of March, Monsieur Desportes of Paris hires a room in the Hotel Blanc in Lyon. On the following day, he goes out early in the morning, leaving word that should a lady whom he was expecting call, she was to be shown up to his room. The same
Sexy.
Morning, a gentleman resembling Monsieur Desportes of Paris bought two ladies' dresses at a shop in Lyon. That same afternoon, a lady dressed in black silk with a hood well drawn down over her eyes called into the office of a notary, a Monsieur Pura.
Oh, come on.
The lady gives her name as Madame de la Motte and asks to write up a contract that is to be sent to her husband that would give him the interest that is due on 30,000 livres. So in theory, some of this money that she has stolen will go to support her husband.
But
here,
I feel bad.
I feel bad. Have the interest that is accruing on this sum of money.
She's saying all of this in a kind of like, yes, my husband
absolutely
wanted me to do this kind of voice.
Yep.
In French, obviously.
All in French. It's much more sexy. Now, Madame de la Motte claims to have recommended to Monsieur Pura by a person he knows, a respectable businessman. He has no reason to distrust Madame de la Motte, and he draws up the necessary documents. Madame de la Motte says that I will not have time to wait around in Lyon for these to be finished and finalised and things, so can you send them off to the Paris priest near Besançon and deliver them to him, and he will then take them to my husband, and he can then claim, in theory, this money.
Okay.
Now, when Monsieur Desportes returns to the hotel, he is told that Madame de la Motte has called twice during his absence and asked for him, but she could not stay.
No.
She had places to be, and she could not wait.
She came in, her magnificent beard was needed. Oh, no, he was beardless.
Oh, so. he was definitely beardless.
Yes, but, I mean, coughing and just kind of scratching his Adam's apple the size of his head.
But, I mean, I have to say, I mean, all credit.
All to credit him. To I mean, this man.
There are wheels within wheels of this plot. I mean, there are alibis and witnesses and things all over the bloody place.
Oh my God.
It is quite incredible.
He's got a touch for the dramatic. Oh hasn't
God,
he?
Yes, absolutely.
Theatrical side of him, and I am here for it.
Love it. But unfortunately, in Paris, things are not going quite as smoothly as they are in Lyon. Monsieur de Lamotte has finally got his arse out of Besançon and arrived in Paris. He goes straight to the lieutenant of police, who places the investigation in the hands of quite a senior magistrate. Now, at first, the magistrate believes that the case is one of fraud and that Madame de Lamotte and her son are actually being imprisoned somewhere and held by Monsieur Deroux. But as he investigates further, he discovers the sort of tale of the illness, the date of the disappearances, the reputed documents that have been signed by Madame de Lamotte. And he is very suspecting that this is actually a case of murder.
Murderousness.
Entirely murderous.
There's murderousness going on.
When Deroux returns to Paris from Lyon on the March the 11th, he finds that the police have already visited his house, questioned his wife, and that he is actually under close surveillance. Now, how he knows that, potentially French policemen behind pillar boxes and things like that spying on him.
They're just all on bicycles.
All on bicycles, absolutely.
Just cycling past the same house 20 times a day.
A day or two later, when the new power of attorney arrives, the signature is compared with that of the deed of sale of Besançon that Deroux has presented. Both are pronounced to be forgeries. This is not my wife's signature. Deroux is arrested and he is sent to prison.
Ah, the bastard.
Now, under the stress of interrogation, pokey things.
But then, you know, given his touch for the theatrics, I'm thinking, okay, fine, he's great at the theatrics, and they go, okay, well, let's just interrogate him, and they just touch one fingernail. I'll tell you everything!
I mean, I would be exactly the same. I mean, you threaten me with anything sharp, I'll tell you whatever if I can like.
I am going to turn up the heat just a bit too much, so yeah. It's uncomfortably humid.
Oh, my friends are under a bus.
So, I'm going to give you a warm white wine. No!
No! You bastards! It was Sinead, it was all her. She planned the whole thing. So under this warm white wine interrogation, his rather flimsy financial claims fall to pieces. Mm-hmm. He has to admit that he has actually never paid Madame de Lamotte 100,000 livres. He says he only paid her 25,000.
A piddling amount.
Made up in mainly of gold, some promissory notes, but mainly just a big old stack of gold. But where that gold has come from, he is unable to say. Still, I mean, he thinks his position is not that bad. Madame Lamotte is not there. He cannot be charged with anything in murder until there's no body. It's equally reasonable to suspect that she has run off than he has done anything untoward.
Yeah.
A month passed, and Madame Deroux has probably tried to make things better, tried to help her husband, but she has come up with a rather ill-thought-out plan and follows her husband's example by trying to impersonate Madame de Lamotte in Paris.
For fuck's sake.
And to prove her aliveness. It did not go well. She is also arrested and imprisoned.
God, what did she do?
I don't know, unfortunately.
Did she
exactly.
put on, like, did she just put on a bad... She's a woman already.
She's also, yes, she is indeed a woman.
She put on a terrible wig and go around shouting in the streets. Yep. I'm Madame So-and-so.
Well, perhaps she dressed up as her husband who was dressed up as Madame de Lamotte. So, but it did not go well. So it is instantly found and she is arrested and imprisoned.
That is literally like a cartoon kind of thing. Like, I'm going to go out and impersonate her. Scene missing. Into the police station instantly. Oh, that escalated. Quickly.
On April the 18th, information is received by the authorities leading them to a wine cellar. Now, I don't know what this information was, unfortunately. Whether they found out, well, he must have paid for this wine cellar somehow. But they were going through his record and say, oh, he's paying rent on this cellar or something like that. But they discover a disturbed floor and a distinct lack of wine. And they think, this is not quite right.
Yes.
Perhaps he's buried his wine, they think. Let's
There's
dig it up.
One policeman at the back going, I hear if you bury the wine, it actually improves its flavour.
Yes.
And they're like, where exactly are you from?
So they do unearth a corpse, Madame de la Motte's corpse. At first, Derues refuses to accept that they are the remains of Madame de la Motte. It's nothing to do with him. He hasn't been in that cellar for months. It could have been planted any time.
It's just coincidence I was in that cellar once.
Anyone could have pushed it there and stolen his wine and replaced it with a corpse.
That's the ultimate prank.
Absolutely. He then goes on to say, I did give her some harmless medicine, but one morning I woke up and she was dead. Entirely nothing to do with him, but out of fear that her husband would accuse him of something terrible, he decides he's got to hide the body.
Okay, well, the justified fear, I think.
I mean, justified fear, absolutely. I mean, he also confesses at this point that her son has also died of this same illness and that he has also been buried.
It's all unravelling now.
It's all desperately unravelling. On the 23rd of April, the body of the young de la Motte is exhumed. Both bodies are examined and the doctors declare themselves satisfied that mother and son have both died from a bitter and corrosive poison administered by some kind of drink.
Ooh.
They did not confirm exactly what poison had been used at this point, but on later investigation, it was believed that both deaths were caused by corrosive sublimate.
Ooh.
Mercury chloride.
Mercury!
That we have encountered before,
yes,
very
only
rarely.
Once.
Yes,
only
indeed.
Only once in this time. Mercury chloride,
so
nice.
Corrosive.
Yes, nasty.
Which is going to do
that's
desperately unpleasant things during the side. Now, justice moves swiftly in Paris. Trial lasts one day. He maintains that he has not poisoned anyone. His only crime, he says, lay in concealing the deaths. He admits to that, but I did not kill anyone. Mm-hmm. Madame Derues says, it is Besancon that has ruined us. I always told my husband that he was mad to buy these properties.
Well, yeah, it seems she's right.
Yeah, well, she says, I'm sure my husband is not a poisoner. I trusted my husband and believed every word he says.
Which is
somewhat naive if that's true. The court sentences.
Sweet
and stupid. Court sentences Derues to death. Deferred judgment on his wife's case because she is pregnant.
Pregnant!
So,
love
yes,
it.
They,
love
they
def- the pregnancy thing.
They defer the judgment. At 6 o'clock in the morning on May the 6th, Derues is taken to a room. Terrifying, scary room, and subjected to torture.
Oh.
He has already been condemned to death, but they felt it would be better if he confessed. It would be better for his soul if he confessed, so we're going to help him with that confession.
Surely not a warm margarita.
Now the doctors declare him too delicate to undergo.
I would be 100% behind that. I'm too delicate.
You may recall the tale of the Marquise de Brinvilliers,
yes,
a while back, and she was subjected to the extraordinary torture of having to force water down her throat.
Ugh.
Now, yeah, Derues was said, no, he will not survive this.
Because he has to survive, doesn't he?
Yep.
So he can be burned or executed.
So they decide to go with the slightly less severe torture of the boot.
Okay, brain overload, sorry. He's going to get in a booting. Sorry, Simpsons reference. Simpsons,
yeah.
There are Simpsons fans all over going, it's a booting, just a little kick in the bum. That's it.
No, this is slightly more unpleasant.
Oh, they just kick him with an ordinary shoe? I believe it's a wingtip?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Sorry.
In fact, his legs are encased in wood, and wooden wedges are then hammered through.
Oh, fuck off!
Until the flesh is crushed and the bones are broken.
That's not booting!
No,
that's not a booting!
It's a very unpleasant form of booting.
It's nothing to do with boots! No, because the boots go up
because,
to the knee.
Yeah, because he's wearing like wooden.
Oh, just kick him with a boot. Come on!
No, but he does. He confesses to nothing. He does not give any confession.
Really?
I mean, that sounds, I mean, unbelievably painful, obviously.
You know you're going
to
die anyway.
And he confesses, he confesses to nothing.
Fair enough.
That afternoon, he is taken to Notre Dame. And in front of the cathedral in the square, his sentence is read to the huge crowd that have been gathered. Again, he protests his and his wife's innocence.
Hmm.
Unlike the Marquis de Brinvilliers before him, whose noble birth affords some sort of gentler treatment, Derues has to endure everything that the law will throw at him.
Oh, fuck.
The square is full. The windows of the overlooking houses, people actually pay to get the best viewing spots.
That's awful, and I would totally do
that. Yeah, people bring stools and ladders
and snacks.
So that, and snacks, so they can get a better view of what's going on. He is strapped to the wheel. His bones and the limbs are smashed by an iron bar. He is thrown alive onto the fire, and his ashes are then scattered into the wind. And people clam around to grab a handful of ashes as a souvenir, like they would in the UK or in England, get a piece of the hangman's rope from Tyburn as a souvenir. They scramble to get handfuls of ashes from the fire. 2 months after the execution of her husband, Madame Duru gives birth to a baby boy who is swiftly taken away. The judgment of her case goes on for years still. Many just want to get it over and done with, forget about the whole thing, sentence her for fraud. But Monsieur de Lamotte, he is not content. He wants vengeance. He is not satisfied with the execution of her husband. He wants her to suffer. He is even found to have bribed witnesses to say that Madame Duru has actually played a much greater part in this than she actually had. Eventually, Parliament decide to be done with the whole thing. They convene a secret session. She is sentenced to be publicly flogged, to be branded on both shoulders with a letter V. V for Valouse, which is a thief or robber, and then imprisoned for life.
Wow. Why brand her if she's going to be in prison?
It hurts.
I know, but flogging hurts.
Gotta get something in there. 10 years pass. A fellow prisoner describes Madame Duru as a scheming, malicious, capable of anything. She is accused of being violent, wishing to revenge herself by setting fire to Paris.
Wow.
That is pretty much the end of Madame Duru. She dies in prison. The revolution, French Revolution, kicks off. At one point of the revolution, they storm the prisons and massacre everyone inside.
Really? She died in
and
massacre?
And she dies. She is one of the prisoners to die in the massacre of the prisons. That is a tale of Antoine de really fancy name Duru. And
Yay!
A crazy, crazy tale.
Fantastic.
Full of cross-dressing poisoners. Which is, who'd have thought we needed more of them?
It's exactly. That's amazing. Oh, I love it. That's a great story.
It's a good story.
Oh, I like him. I like him because he's ballsy.
Oh, God, yeah. He must be fun at the party.
He must have been so much fun. He must have been theatric and just... He probably meant for a life on the stage, or one of those very arrogant kind of, I'm going to be a star and really charming and fun, but actually is a bit of a wanker. And then the cross-dressing, oh, for God's sake. Then wine must be buried. That story had everything.
Lots of terrifying things.
Oh, good. And torture.
A bit of torture. We always like a bit of torture.
I don't know. Booting, I'm never going to look at the same way again. The whole of the Simpsons Australia episode was playing through my head there.
Excellent.
Well, if that's put you in the mood for red wine.
Red wine in a boot.
Red wine in a boot. And a good booting. And cross-dressing as well. Just
Absolutely.
Have some red wine. Do some cross-dressing. See how far
pictures.
You get. It's Friday night. For some of you, it's in lockdown. So put on a bonnet, drink some wine, and see how far this goes.
See how, where the evening takes you.
Fantastic story, as always, Nick. What do you think, guys? What do you think of the French poisoners? Another one from the 1700s. We fucking love the 1700s.
Oh, they're great, absolutely.
It's such a good time. Stories. You know what? During lockdown, during this weekend, everyone dress up in the style of the 1700s, in the style of all the French nobles.
I want a flowery dressing gown.
Yeah, a flowery dressing gown and a bonnet. Take pictures, because otherwise it's just bleak if you're doing this in your house alone. send us your thoughts and send us your pictures. We're going into lockdown. Keep positive, keep happy, and keep listening to us. And send us suggestions of more stories. You've got time in your hands now, some of you. So send us suggestions of stories you want to hear or anything else that we can do to make lockdown a little cheerier for you. Come and visit us on the social media. Have a chat. Come and find us on Patreon. Loads of extra content on there. If you are looking for Christmas gifts, two parts to this. On one hand, do consider the Poisoner Cabinet merch. We've got loads of things in there. But if you are thinking about Christmas and you're in lockdown, you're thinking about what to do, shop local. Support local independent businesses. We cannot stress this enough.
Quite. I agree.
Yeah, support each other. Reach out to friends and family. Reach out to us. Reach out to other podcasts and stay really positive and healthy and happy. We have been the people inside the Poisoner's Cabinet. We will see you next week. And remember, your loved ones are trying to kill you.
Bye.